welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, RFURL's Monday podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman, and my guest this week is Ian Garner, an expert on Russian war propaganda, and an author on this issue as well. I'm grateful to Ian for joining me today because our topic is the celebration last week of the 80th anniversary of the end of the Battle of Stalingrad in World War II, and Ian has written a book called Stalingrad Lives. It was published in December, so very recently, and it explores how Soviet propagandists created a myth of the battle that has captured Soviet and Russian minds for 80 years. So it would be great to hear Ian's take on the way President Vladimir Putin and the Kremlin have used the anniversary of this horrific battle kind of as propaganda in the context of their horrific war against Ukraine. Thank you very much for joining me today, Ian.
Thanks for having me, and good morning or good afternoon to everybody.
All right. It's great to have you on the podcast again, Ian. So what I wanted to do first is really just give you the floor to talk about the Battle of Stalingrad and how Putin and the Russian state marked 80 years since this month-long battle that was extremely destructive and deadly, ended with the defeat of Nazi Germany's forces by the Soviet army in the southern city then known as Stalingrad and now known as Volgograd. And I thought I would first provide some background, but then decided to pretty much leave that to you as well, Ian. So I'm eager to hear your thoughts.
Perfect. So I'll give you a brief overview of the battle itself and why it was so important, what the Russians made of it at the time and how they've used it since, and then that will lead me into talking about this year's let's say spectacularly interesting version of the celebrations. So Stalingrad took place in the middle of World War II, and it was kind of a last-ditch effort by the Soviets. Military historians will argue with me endlessly, and that's okay. But it was seen as a last-ditch effort. Stalingrad stands, the Soviet Union survives. If Stalingrad falls, then it will either lose the war or be drawn into a horrible, nightmarish conflict that could have gone on for years and years and years. About a million people on each side died, and it looked for several months like the Soviets were going to lose the battle. Somewhat miraculously, they managed to put together a plan, beat the Germans very rapidly in mid-November 1942, and the turnaround happened really, really quickly. At the time, it was perceived as a miracle that the city itself had been completely battered, destroyed. There were, you know, hundreds of thousands of people dying. People kind of expected to lose, and then suddenly, within weeks, the German army was surrounded, the battle was over, and that was basically it, really, for the Germans' hopes of winning the war and winning on the Eastern Front. So why this has been so important to Russia is that Stalingrad is seen, in the West at least, if you were asked to pick some words associated with Stalingrad, you would probably tell me about starving troops, about cold, that this is the epitome of wartime suffering. But from the Russian perspective, this isn't. It's quite the opposite. It was a necessary suffering to win the war, where a million soldiers didn't just regrettably die, a million soldiers necessarily had to be sacrificed, a kind of martyrdom, to save the world, save Russia, and create life anew. So Stalingrad isn't the end of something, it's the beginning of something. It's the beginning of life after the war. It's the beginning of the future. And this is the myth that the Soviets have kept coming back to for several decades. This is a myth that Putin in particular has just blown out of all proportions over the last few years with all kinds of state-funded propaganda projects, movies, it's taught in schools, there are parades, we hear constant talk of Volgograd being renamed Stalingrad. I don't think it's going to happen, but, you know, this material is out there, constantly reminding Russians, and this is what I want you to remember, reminding Russians that Russia is under threat existentially, constantly from forces coming from the West, so-called fascists, as they were actually were in 1942. But no matter how much sacrifice has to take place, no matter how many Russians die, the sacrifice is always going to be worthwhile. And that's worth bearing in mind today. When we ask, well, Putin is talking, and he spoke at these celebrations last week, which were huge. There was military parades that mixed up period costume from the time, that mixed up parades of V and Z marked vehicles from the present. This is a war that goes on, a battle that goes on in the past, a battle that goes on in the present. Russians are being told, and when Putin came out on the podium and gave his speech to the veterans and the military officials of today, he told them that Germany is sending tanks, we're at war with the collective West again. What he's telling them is, yeah, things look bleak today. We might not look like we're winning, but just hold tight. Another miraculous turnaround will come. So that is the myth of Stalingrad of 80 years in a nutshell.
I just wanted to ask Ian, I'll try to make it more briefer now, but how believable is the idea, you know, that Putin and the Kremlin are putting across, you know, that this, you know, Russia is now sort of at war against the West? I read that the Dmitry Kisilov on state TV said, you know, that in World War II, most of the countries of the West were on Germany's side, which is obviously not true. Do you think that this kind of propaganda is credible to Russians, given the fact that they're now, that many Western countries were on the same side as the Soviet Union in World War II?
I think it is credible. It's incredible in the sense that it doesn't make any logical sense. There's nothing that's rational about it, but there's never anything that's rational about authoritarian and totalitarian discourse. But this taps into much older historical myths as well, and these are historical myths that the Putin government has taken great care to teach in school classrooms and propagandize through popular culture over the last few years. This is the idea that Russia is always under threat by somebody or other. The idea that there is this idea of Moscow the Third Rome, that after the fall of Constantinople in 1453 to Muslim forces, that Russia has been the sole defender of Christianity and civilization in the world. The idea that Russia has long been under attack from Poland is often singled out as an aggressor in the version of history that today's state likes to present. The idea that in World War I, Russia was surrounded by dubious allies, by spies. There is an excellent book, if you're interested in this, by a guy called Ilya Yablokov, who I believe works at Leeds in the UK, and it's called Fortress Russia, and it's all about conspiracy theories around this sort of history and how widespread they are. They're deeply ingrained, not just in popular culture and popular memory, but also in the way that sort of academics and talking heads talk about Russia and talk about the state and history. This is not a fringe pursuit. And of course, the experience of the 1990s, as it's been remembered by Russians broadly, has been one where Russia was a great and powerful nation up until the 1980s. And, you know, again, you can dispute the reality of this, but this is the popular story. Russia was a great and powerful nation up until the 1980s. It was betrayed by people who wanted to sell it out to the West. And then Russia was looted in the West by sort of rampaging barbarian capitalists. So what we get today is just a hot war version of that same narrative of betrayal and threat of Russia as an isolated nation. And when we look at the discourses around this, and lots of research has been done on this, Russians of all generations, including younger Russians, do tend to pick up on this and reiterate these stories quite widely.
That's very interesting. I found like it seemed like this year the speech at the anniversary in Volgograd by Putin was he'd almost rehearsed it in the past, successive Victory Day parades on May 9th, which over the years he began as fewer and fewer Western leaders were coming, and there was, you know, tensions were higher and higher. He kind of segued into this, into saying that the world, you know, the world and Russia now threatened again by forces that are similar to those of Hitler's Germany. And he would kind of hint for a few years, he would sort of hint, and you wouldn't really know, is he talking about, you know, Al-Qaeda or Islamic State, or is he talking about the United States, or at least I couldn't tell. I thought he was alluding to both. And then it became clearer and clearer and sort of more straightforward. And then this year, you know, now at the Stalingrad anniversary, he's just stating it outright. And I think Medvedev and others, you know, in his circle have also been making the same point that this is, and of course it dovetails with the narrative that the war in Ukraine is actually a war against the West and NATO, and one that somehow the West has started.
Absolutely, you're right. And what's interesting to me is that this is feeds into this narrative that this is a war that Russia didn't start. This is a war where supposedly Putin's hands were tied. He had no option, as was true in 1942 in Stalingrad, no option but to fight. We're the ones that are under attack, and therefore we're just defending ourselves. We're defending quote-unquote ethnic Russians in Ukraine, and if we don't fight, then somehow Russia will be destroyed. Now, that was true in 1942, of course, when the German invaders were carrying out a genocide against multiple nations, including against Slavs, right? The violence on the Eastern Front was truly shocking. But you're right as well, Steve, that this is a narrative that Putin has kind of inflated over the years. When you look back to his first Victory Day speech from 2000, it was very traditional in the sense that he said something along the lines of, you know, we need to remember the past. It's important to become the veterans of the past. It's important to emulate them in order to ensure that the country blossoms today. So it's kind of a riposte to the supposed forgetting and the rampant sort of mafia capitalism in the 1990s. And then you take it through sort of the 2010s, in particular after Crimea in 2014, when the language very much was along the lines of, well, there is a Western bloc of powers who are trying to make us forget, a Western bloc of powers who we need to be suspicious of. But what really struck me about the speech that he made last week in Volgograd was you don't often see Putin making emotional speeches. Usually he's quite a dry speaker. He's actually quite a dull speaker. Right. Part of his appeal is that he's kind of businesslike. He's surrounded by pizzazz and lights and PR and marketing and songs and celebrities. But he himself is very businesslike. He's quite a slow speaker, quite a steady and measured speaker. But he seemed quite angry last week. It was, I can't quite call it fiery because he'll never be a firebrand, I don't think. But there was this real streak of sort of rage and disgust about this, you know, fairy tale situation of Russia being surrounded by enemies that I haven't really seen much from Putin before. And it said to me, and of course I'm guessing because you don't know what's happening behind closed doors, but it just screams to me that he doesn't seem to be stepping back or looking for a way out of the war. He seems to be doubling down on this fury and doubling down on these narratives of betrayal and isolation and existential threats.
That's a very good point about his sort of emotionality that you don't see often, and that kind of ties in with the other question that I wanted to ask you, which is a bit narrower than the first one, but I'm not sure it's easy to answer. The question is: does Putin's focus on the past, in this speech, in what he's been saying about the war and about the Battle of Stalingrad, does it say anything about how this war that he's unleashed in the present, in Ukraine, will proceed? I mean, One might expect a leader whose country is at war to speak about the war in more specific terms, as Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, I think, has done in his nearly daily remarks. He talks about things happening on the battlefield and other issues that are quite directly related to the war. But Putin's Volgograd speech and most of his other addresses, I would say, he's used them to kind of repeat broad claims that are obviously false, or at least obviously to some, such as that Ukraine is run by neo-Nazis, that Kiev committed genocide in the Donbass, and that Russia essentially faces, existential situation. These claims are false, and in this case, he drew a badly flawed parallel with World War II. What do you think, Ian? Does this say anything about how the Kremlin, how Putin is approaching this war almost a year after Putin ordered the large-scale invasion of Ukraine?
As you're speaking, a little phrase comes to mind that became a sort of a rallying cry of some of the more nationalist elements of the Russian intellectual sphere in the 1990s, when supposedly everything was falling apart for Russia and, the war was being forgotten. And that phrase is «Борьба продолжается», the battle continues. The idea that we're constantly fighting for something, we constantly have to be sort of looking out for these threats on the outside. And Putin's just kind of constantly dripping back into the culture, usually around these sort of celebratory or ritual events. And there is something ritual, something almost religious about the way that this is treated. It's resistant to our readings of normal time and logic. But I think really he's challenged in the ways that he can talk about the battle, the war today. Because the end goal of the special military operation has never been clear, because it doesn't really correlate with reality. The reality is you can't denazify Ukraine, because there is nothing to denazify, because there aren't Nazis in Ukraine. It's not led by some sort of Banderist far-right government. So what is Russia's goal? We can't say, well, we need to fight another Stalingrad today because we're going to cast Hitler out of Berlin. Right. So how can he be more specific? Well, he can't, especially as Russia continues to, if right now they're not actively losing in the way that they were in the fall, they're not exactly showering themselves with glory either. It's not very apparent what the next steps are. Whereas at Stalingrad, the promise was always, if you die today, then victory is right around the corner. This is the last great and final battle.
Yeah, absolutely. So I see what you're saying. He's challenged in terms of what he can actually say that kind of has a real relation to the war in reality. I guess one of the messages may be that, the war will continue, as I think you said earlier in this conversation, the idea that what he's been saying definitely gives no hint of suggesting that he's ready to kind of give up. I think that's one signal, I guess, from it is the fact that still, I guess, hoping the Western support for Ukraine will flag, and hoping for a change on the battlefield. And of course, there is talk, of a potential Russian offensive. Ukraine's talking about it, and analysts are talking about it, that could be coming up very soon. That is obviously something to watch. Right, we're getting a bit short on time, but let's take a few questions if there are any. I outlined some of the ways you can ask a question. Okay, hold on. Uh, I see a hand raised, I think, by... Sorry, I don't see the full name. Sovereign? Sorry. Do you want to request speaking privilege? Sorry, do you want to, I think you need to request to be a speaker if you want to ask the question. Okay, maybe not. All right, any
hello.
Yes, great, go ahead.
Yeah, my question is, recently, in this $2.2 billion package passed to Ukraine, they included these long-range missiles, GLSDB, and they intended them for pretty much liberating Crimea, because they said they don't recognize Crimea as part of Russian Federation, but Ukrainian territory. So what would happen... theoretically, this is just a hypothetical question, if the Russian Federation decided not to recognize California and Alaska as United States territory?
I mean, I'm not sure what the question is, really, because Alaska and California are part of America's territory, but Ukraine is not part of Russia's territory, so I'm not sure there's much more to say about that.
Yeah, I guess I would add maybe that we don't know what's going to happen with Crimea in the next few months or years. But the idea of Russia saying, oh, we never gave Alaska away, never sold Alaska, or oh, California is ours. You know, I don't see that as kind of a real prospect. Any time in the near or even distant future. So I'm not sure, you know, what would happen. Okay. Any other questions, from listeners? Be happy to take one or two. Just give it a few more moments.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
Okay. My question is, for me, the whole thing is part of it. It's not maybe all. It's like a robbery. Putin wants, or Russia wants to, rob Ukraine, Kiev, the National Bank, all companies, all what they can get to be more rich and anything else. And they are playing it now because they got their long fingers beaten, like a poker game. They tell the West and all others, look, we can raise our input. We will send there another 200,000 soldiers and then another 100. And they hope they can raise it so much that we say, okay, we don't dare to go on. Even if they have a very bad cards and would lose, we don't dare to go on. So, but the question is for me, how can we stop it or deal with it that they are raising the input again and again and again?
I'm not sure I quite followed the question. Are you asking how can we stop the war?
Yes, there's a kind of playing to make it the level higher and higher. That the input is higher, and people in the West and everywhere fear to go on with this game.
If you're worried about the extent to which the West is willing to continue to support Russia.
Yes. To support Ukraine, yeah.
No, sorry, to support Ukraine, of course. I think the signs are still promising. I think the signs are still good. The fact that we're having a relatively warm winter is certainly helping, but the big event that I think we all need to be looking forward to is the elections in America at the end of next year, because I suspect that this war in some way will still be going on.
So long.
Well beyond when those elections take place. And so most of the support and most of the leadership in real monetary terms is coming from the states still. And it really depends on the states' leadership and money. If they continue to supply it after those elections, then Ukraine will continue to receive support. If they don't, then I wonder if they might have a more broad sort of contagion towards support in the West widely.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's a good point. And I think, I'm pretty sure that Putin is thinking about that quite a bit in I don't think he's said much about it and maybe wouldn't in the near future. But I think that has to be, the U.S. elections have to be a factor in his thinking and what they're doing. I think Hans, you mentioned kind of continuing to get more and more troops, send more and more troops to the battle. And in my mind, it seems like, Putin may be kind of counting on or hoping for a change in the West. As Ian said, things look pretty promising, but that he may be hoping for a change in the West, over the next, couple of years. So that will be potentially a big factor. Okay. Any other questions? I think we could take one more.
Hello, it's Rafi from Germany. I'm just wondering, what do you estimate the war machinery in Russia, the output in the coming years? I mean, it's clear that Putin now switched to a war economy. And I'm wondering, since they were apparently running out of tanks, in some cases you have already seen the T-62 appearing at the front. So I'm just wondering, what can they actually throw at the front, at the Ukraine front, in the near future, looking at the sanctions that are really getting hold now there and the economy basically going downhill. What can the output of the war machinery actually achieve in Russia?
It's an excellent question, Ralph, and I'm not the expert on supply and logistics, but it seems like there's a very broad range of opinions amongst Western experts between Russia's economy is really very much struggling, and in particular it's struggling to produce the things it needs for the war. And those on the other side who say that Russia is adapting quite quickly, that its partnerships with other countries, in particular, we saw the news, was it yesterday or a couple of days ago? I was traveling and confused about what happened when, as you often are when you're jet lagged. The news about the planned Iranian drone factory in Russia itself. So there's all sorts of opportunities for Russia to change what's happening and intervene. And the longer the war goes on, the more that Ukraine will depend on support from the West, because its own economy is being devastated by the war. It's something that's not talked about very much. But the longer also that Russia may have an opportunity to reorient its economy and fix some of those problems.
Okay, thanks for that. I definitely have nothing to add. I'm not an expert on those issues at all. Do you have another question from Daniel, if you want to go ahead.
Hey, one simple question. Very, very simple. Supposedly, in the spring, summer, they will come to Mariupol, Berdyansk, Melitopol. And the atrocities will be much, much, much higher than we saw in Irpin, Bucha, right? What will happen with Russian mindset? Because they need to assess this. Collective guilt is not something you can blame just, Putin. Patrushev. They are ready, because I read Russian intellectuals who were persecuted. And they say, very clear, it's our fault. It's not just imperial heritage. They can change their mindset.
I mean, this is an area of great concern to me and something I've been thinking about for the last few months deeply. And we have two issues here, really. The first is finding bringing the perpetrators of war crimes to justice, which is going to be extremely difficult because those who aren't captured at the front are not likely to be given up easily by Russia. And of course that applies even to a greater extent to the Russian leadership, who it's going to be very difficult to punish unless Russia collapses completely and they're extradited. But that doesn't seem very likely to me, at least not in the near term. And the second issue is what to do with the broader population who are at best apathetic to the war. And I would veer nearer to saying that the public broadly embraces the war to some degree and is fine with the idea of the war. They're frustrated with elements of how it's being conducted in terms of the Russian death toll, but we're seeing very little opposition to the idea that a war in Ukraine is something that could or should be fought. And so the question is, how can we influence those people today? Well, the answer is we can. We can run influence campaigns. We can run propaganda campaigns. We can get material about reality out there. We can show examples of what it means to be a good Russian rather than somebody who supports war crimes. And there are Russian opposition leaders and Russian opposition members or those who are more inclined towards the opposition who are very keen to change the narrative about Russian imperialism and move towards something that is a much more full and frank accounting of what Russia is doing today and has done over the last decades. So all hope is not lost, but it's going to be extremely difficult and it's going to take support at the state level rather than just the ground up level to really enact any significant change.
All right. Thanks very much for that answer. And thank you for the question, you know, kind of, in a very, very kind of a disturbing issue that we're going to be dealing with, in the future. So thanks for that. We're short on time, so let's wrap it up. Thank you very much, for the questions. And Ian, thanks for joining me. It was really enlightening, and I hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you for having me. It was an absolute pleasure.
All right. Thank you. Great to have you. The pleasure is mine. Once again, I've been speaking to Dr. Ian Garner, an expert on Russian war propaganda, whose new book, Stalingrad Lives, explores how Soviet propagandists created a myth of the battle that has captured Soviet and Russian minds for 80 years, and we're seeing today and last week how it's still being used. Now, Ian is working on his second book about fascism and the future of Russia, which is also a particularly important issue at this time. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. As I mentioned at the start, this conversation will be published as a podcast, and you can subscribe to The Week Ahead in Russia and other RFERL podcasts on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you listen to podcasts. I'll be back again next Monday for another Week Ahead in Russia, and please keep an eye out on Fridays for my newsletter, The Week in Russia. Thanks for listening.